Good afternoon. My name is Paul Smart, and this is The Work Show. Today we're talking with a classical pianist who also happens to be a businessman, Justin Kolb, who's one of the leading figures behind the Phoenicia Festival of the Voice, which will be going on the first weekend in August this year.
Music students process data differently. Mm-hmm. It's quicker, it's more accurate, and bang! That the result of a process of data is helpful information. That's the output. And that's the way the brain works. And I do run, public schools are often asking me to do motivational clinics for their, it's interesting, for their band kids, their choir kids, the orchestra kids, and their parents. And they really try to point me in the direction of middle school because they lose band members between middle and secondary and high school because it's not necessarily cool. In the motivational workshop that I present, I get kids to tell me, what kind of skills do you think you're developing because you are a serious music student? And after some kickstarting and pumping them a bit, we've already discussed what it takes to be a serious musician and or actor. And that is they got to practice, which means they develop a very acute ability to focus, let alone the self-discipline that is part of the, you know, gold that's mined from these hours of practicing. Two, they must study with a master. The third point of that is that they perform with others, and this allows them very acute listening skill development. And fourthly, they appear in public. These four things, they do that, they will do well on the SATs, and they will do well in life. And when I ask them, what kind of skills do you think you're developing because of those four points? This is your life. They tell me things like, I'm a good listener. And I tell them, isn't that interesting? The Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, who bring us Scotch tape, they require effective listening workshop attendance on the part of all employees who manage people, who interact with customers, and who are involved with safety. So let's write that on the whiteboard. Okay, we've got listening skills. And I put down there 3M Company, AT&T, because they have run effective listening workshops. Listening is a skill that the military and the medical industry is also interested in having people enhance their, I mean, we all can listen, whether or not we listen effectively. These kids get that at a very early age. Problem solving, attention to detail. They're very quick to tell me they are risk takers. Mm-hmm. And they are very quick to tell me that they can accept criticism. And I tell them at the end, of, you know, an average class will come up with maybe 12 skills. I was running a session at the San Francisco Performing Arts High School. They came up with 45 skills in about 7 minutes. It was crazy. And I tell them when we're finished, say, look at this list. Go home, write your own inventory of those skills that you think you've learned because of music. Skills that are helpful to you when you're away from the world of music. These are life survival skills. And then the next time your mom or dad or someone says, where's all that money going for horn lessons? Pull out your skills inventory list from your wallet or bag, your backpack, and say, this is the person I'm becoming because of these skills learned in band or in orchestra or in choir. So I get rather passionate about this. I'm sorry. I guess it could be said I have three projects, or three major ones. I'm a concert pianist. I'm the luckiest guy I know. I get paid to do what I want to do. It's got to put me in, if not 1%, 2% of the world. People give me money to do what I want to do. And I do it on my own terms. I do things that work for me better than other ways. For instance, I always use music. And I found it interesting that no critics have ever noticed or remarked on the fact that I use music. And there are pianists who criticize me for using music. It's funny. If one uses music, it changes, at least in my case, it changed the way I played the piano. It slowed me down and made me start noticing the long arcs that are written over the staves that are just as important as notes. And that's called phrasing. And it's taken me a career, a lifetime, to learn how to phrase. And if you can phrase right, then you can tell a story. And if you're a performer and cannot tell a story, there's nothing wrong with that, but sit on the other side of the orchestra pit. And some of the other decisions that I've made are regarding repertoire. I try to play music as Leon Botstein likes to refer to it as, music that lives in undeserved obscurity. And an example of that is the barefoot Carmelite composer and piano virtuoso Herman Cohen, who was a ward and a protege of Franz Liszt, and I have access to his piano music, and the story of his life is right, sort of very Da Vinci Code-esque, and it's exciting to play his music. He's not a great composer. He's in the middle, maybe, of the 19th century, and wrote wonderful operatic transcriptions. In fact, I think I'm scheduled to play it during the Birdcliff Festival, when an organization I'm connected with, the Festival of the Voice, is going to present a concert, which should be quite something. And as far as repertoire goes, and
well, that brings up the kind of other two things that, just so we can move and
good.
Come back to some of that, is your involvement with opera and the Festival of the Voice.
You know, I used to go to opera once a year, and the only reason I went to opera once a year was so I wouldn't feel guilty as I have a degree in music. I had no interest in it, and I have learned from Louis Oti and Maria Tadaro, sometimes pronounced Tadaro, and wonderful people like Stephen White from the Met and Barry Banks, the exciting tenor. That's just, you know, his career's on fire. Elizabeth Futrell. They have really taught Barbara, my wife and former booking agent, they've taught us to really, funny thing, listen for a change. I'm fascinated by the logistics of opera, but the music is wonderful, and the music comes from the purest instrument of all, the human body, and with nothing as serving as a modem. I've got a piano as my modem for conveying Western art music, and it's terrific. What I do is I serve as the chairman of the Phoenicia International Festival of the Voice, and that's because I'm the oldest guy there. And it's a 4-day festival, the centerpiece of which is an opera. We've done Falstaff, Butterfly, Rigoletto this year, because and the Verdi Requiem, and it is the bicentennial of the birth of Verdi. So, and curiously, it's also the bicentennial of Richard Wagner. So we will also have on Friday night of the first weekend in August, we will be doing a concert of Wagner. We try to find emerging artists. These are artists, not kids. I mean, we mentor kids that are in sometimes secondary school, sometimes elementary. We believe in helping to train the audience of the future and the singers of the future. So there's a lot of educational programs we have. But on Friday night, the Voices of Distinction, which is now one of the popular events in our festival and has been for 3 years, these are young artists who have appeared on Broadway or on the stage, and we audition. We have auditions in a couple of different locations, but most of the time in New York City. We audition them and select those that we think really have a shot at a major career, a shot at uplifting and enhancing every member of an audience in the future. And we have the Festival Symphony Orchestra, which is the core of which will be the Westfield Symphony in New Jersey, and David Rowe, extraordinary conductor, he's good. So he's going to do the Requiem, but our traditional conductor for the opera continues to be Stephen White, who is on the conducting staff at the Metropolitan Opera. And then during the day, there are day events and the four evening events. The first event I didn't mention in the evening, and it opens the festival, is Thursday evening, August 1st, and that's gospel. Mm-hmm. Gospel that's going to knock the socks off of everyone there, and it's they're all sold out. I mean the park isn't sold out, but you know, we pulled in 5,000 people last year, and we think we're going to have more. We're making extra preparations for parking. The logistics will drive you crazy. And and we have various and sundry events. One of them is my very own event, and I'm doing that with Carrie Harrison. Mm-hmm. Whose novel Justice is
I have to review it.
Oh, you're going. Yeah. Oh, yeah, great. So Carrie and I collaborated last year along with Mick Horowitz, and this year, just Carrie and I, we're doing letters. Something we announced a year ago. Letters and readings from personal correspondence from Wagner and Liszt. Of course, there are books written about their personal correspondence. It was on again, off again. Their relationship was very operatic. And Verdi. And one of the curious things that I've learned from Alan Walker, the biographer, 19th century biographer and subject matter expert of Liszt, Verdi and Liszt never met, but they admired the music of each other greatly. And they actually were in a theater together for a concert, and didn't know that the other was there, and so they came close, but never had the opportunity to enjoy each other and learn more about each other.
And then you do like arts and education, don't you, as well?
That's one of my loves and passions, and I get paid to do it, and I've done it from Budapest to Santa Barbara. I was in Santa Barbara. I played, as I mentioned earlier, in San Francisco at the Liszt Festival. So I played, and then I also played, but I spent all day long doing tutorials, what people now call my power lectures, and I gave a two-hour workshop on life after graduation from music school. And it talks about everything they traditionally don't get in a music curriculum: how to set goals, how to write a plan. You know, we're training kids and begging kids, come to music school. We'll give you scholarships, as the instrument manufacturers now underwrite many scholarships, and to get kids to teach general music in our public education system, and run a band, a chorus, hopefully an orchestra as well. Well, we give them music education bachelor degrees, and they can get doctorates all the way up through music education, but nowhere do we really teach them how to develop a budget, an operating budget for the band. How difficult, you know. But there are rules, and what is more important is we don't teach them how to defend that budget when they present it to the principal in front of the school board and have to make a case when the athletic director is saying, I need tackling dummies, I need some new balls, I need this, I need that, our helmets are dull, they need to be shiny, and I'm bringing revenue into the school. The band is not. So there's a world of reality out there that does not match the curriculum inside our conservatories. And so I do two things. I help schools set up a program to do that, and I run, you know, these courses myself, and it's really one thing, one lecture. It's all based around one lecture I have, and I've got about 17 titles. And that lecture has as three major components: entrepreneurism, community engagement, and self-promotion. And this is all a result of, You know, I'm a career advisor for Chamber Music America's annual conference. And people sign up to have there are probably, I think, five advisors, career advisors, people who feel the same way I do about what it takes to really be educated musically, because you got to do more than keep your nose and your hands inside a practice room 8 hours a day. You got to be out there. You have to be opportunistic. Even though Mom taught us that it's wrong to toot our own horn, we literally must do that, but there are standards within which and parameters within which we can operate that. It's professional to self-promote. These are the things that we address. It's sort of a fun story for me to tell. I don't know if it's fun to listen, but I started playing the piano at the age of 4. The reason I did that was my parents went to a local band concert, and this kid got up and did a rip-roaring version of Bumble Boogie, and everybody was talking afterwards that he took lessons from his mother. And so we contacted the mother and my cousin Tom Sarozinski, and Justin Cole began to learn how to play the piano, and his parents had been at the same concert. So Tom and I had every Saturday morning ruined by the fact that we had to drive over to Mrs. Hulse's house and take a piano lesson. And then after a while, she had recommended that I study with another teacher, and I did that, and that teacher was Lillian Whitaker DeCamp, and she was marvelous, and she taught me to love playing the piano. She couldn't teach me how to love practicing, but she could show me the consequences, and I did it. And she was very contest and competition conscious, so she entered all of her students in these contests, and I was lucky enough to win, and I liked it. This was in Hammond, Indiana. Steeltown, USA, sort of a sister metropolitan area to Pittsburgh. We made steel, had petrochemical tank farms all over the place, and it was also on the southern tip of Lake Michigan, about 40 minutes outside of Chicago, so that Mrs. DeCamp, and I had lessons with her on Saturday mornings, and then, although it was wonderful for me, every Sunday afternoon was shot also, because I would go with Mr. and Mrs. DeCamp up to Orchestra Hall. And I heard the great pianists beginning about when I was 8. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I heard Myra Hess, Arthur Rubinstein, Serkin. I saw Serkin. I saw daylight between Serkin's rear end and the piano bench when he performed The Wanderer Fantasy, which, of course, is one of his war horses, mm-hmm. The Wanderer Fantasy by Schubert. And I saw this old lady, and they called her Dame, not Mrs., and it was Myra Hess, who did those fabulous, you know, air raid concerts underground in London during the Blitzkrieg. And that was a good experience for me. I found most of it boring, but I knew there was something there. And then I won a contest and soloed with first the Gary Symphony, and then I auditioned for Fritz Reiner, and he selected me to do the Haydn D Major Concerto under the baton of George Schick. Schick relocated to Manhattan and in the city, and is the man most responsible for developing the Manhattan School of Music as a model for schools of performers and performance. And I didn't do anything different, except that first orchestra rehearsal with the Haydn, I had no understanding of what a real orchestra sounded like. And it was it was empowering beyond belief to me. And
how old were you at that point?
I played with the Chicago Symphony at the age of 10.
Wow.
And got to play with them twice, same concerto, a week apart. And it was extraordinary. I mean, I had no idea how powerful this is. And, I mean, in our house, we had 78s of South Pacific, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents took us to hear the Fred Waring Singers every year, you know, at the Civic Center as the Pennsylvanians came traveling through town. That's how I began. And after I played with Chicago Symphony, I remember we called them the men in the suits, and they visited our house, and they tried to convince my parents that they were going to take me on the road and do glorious things for both Justin Kolb, the Kolb family, and the town of Hammond, Indiana. And they said, absolutely not. And I think it's a good thing they said that. I was not treated as a protege. I had a paper route. I was a Boy Scout. I was an older boy. I got into trouble. I hated doing homework. And most of all, I hated practicing the piano. But I did keep practicing. I mean, the rule was, you know, I practiced an hour a day or I couldn't go out. And then by the time I got to high school, things changed a bit. And I got involved in being, you know, the high school groups and community theater groups could not afford orchestras or background music. So I got these gigs. Sometimes I received money for rehearsing with musicals being produced in the area. And there was a lot of that. There was a lot of Broadway. But at the same time, I performed the orchestra score on the piano with an organist for A Ball in the Night Visitors by Giancarlo Linati. It was great. It was a good life. And then I went to college, got a music scholarship. I knew I was going to get drafted, so I took ROTC and ended up getting a commission as a second Louis in the United States Army. I served as a personnel officer for 4 years and 7 months. I walked out as a captain. The luckiest thing in my life, I never had a short tour, let alone was I being assigned to Vietnam. I don't know why that happened, but, you know, in almost 5 years, I never heard a shot fired in anger. And I liked the military. And at the end of the military, someone said, "You're Justin Kolb, the pianist." And that started a conversation with the United States Information Agency, known overseas as USIS, the Information Service, and the Department of State. And so I spent 18 months giving concerts and talking to student youth groups throughout Europe and the Middle East, and mostly in Europe. But I made it to 10 cities in Iran. It was extraordinary. You know, I was 26 years old. It was romantic.
And this is when Vietnam was active?
Yes, but I was released from the army.
Okay.
Was able to avoid that.
And
no, the concerts were concerts, and they were produced by, usually by the United States Information Service. It was I was a cultural ambassador. I had diplomatic immunity in many places. I was flown on sometimes military aircraft to various sites, and it wasn't easy. I remember it wasn't always getting flown around. I traveled on buses. Sometimes State Department provided limousines. I traveled on trains and or private cars, and the first time out I had to do 21 concerts in 21 different cities within a space of 22 nights, and that was the luckiest thing after avoiding being involved in combat, mm-hmm. probably the luckiest thing that ever happened to me, because that taught me you don't always get to clip your fingernails, get a haircut, put on a clean shirt, and warm your hands to play a recital. I was pulled out of sedans after changing into tails in the back seat of that sedan. I was sweating like a pig. I looked like a pig, and it's a wonder I didn't play like a pig. But it taught me, and I, literally, I would be pushed out on stage. And just, you know, concert started at 1:15. It might be 1:30. And by the time I got out on stage, just due to travel, mm-hmm. Logistical follow-ups, etc. And it taught me, you got to be there and deliver. Then there was the issue of Vietnam still going on, and I often address student youth groups on the subject of Vietnam. I had briefings from the State Department, and what I found surprising was that Europeans were very concerned about our involvement in Vietnam. What Europeans did not know is that their governments were very involved in Vietnam on our side. I mean, there were 1,200 Vietnamese women being trained as nurses by the Republic of Germany. The SS Helgoland, their hospital ship, was in the Gulf of Tonkin and in front of Cam Ranh Bay. There were, I think, 400 to 600, I remember reading the figures because I was provided this information, German technicians on site, on location in the Republic of South Vietnam. I don't know what they were doing. And of course, you could walk through and see an Exxon tank farm in the middle of the jungle. That blew my mind when I found that out. Mm-hmm. And I question this as not being possible, that perhaps the North Vietnamese were getting their gas from the same place we were getting our gas. And someone pointed out to me that was done all the time with submarines in the South Atlantic off the coast of New Jersey. Do you believe that? Which isn't really the South Atlantic. But wild stuff. And it was a grand experience.
You were married at the time?
Yeah, I was going to say. And the third luckiest thing that happened to me was Barbara Mellon, who was a childhood sweetheart from the night we went to the homecoming dance together as juniors in high school, and we are still together. We celebrate our 49th wedding anniversary in August, mm-hmm. and we went together for 6.5 years prior to that time.
And did you have...
And I was married when I was doing this, and we lived on the economy in Mannheim, and we had two kids... And a third one on the way.
So you would tour and then come back?
Yes, I would tour and come back. Wow. And it was great. But I must, Barbara went with me in all of the Western Europe countries. Mm-hmm. With
the kids?
With the kids, yeah. It was great. Mm-hmm. But only to those places where I could drive myself. I mean, it wasn't always 21 concerts in the space of 21 nights. Mm-hmm. But if I knew I had to go up to Luxembourg... I did.
And so from there, what did you...
From there is horrible. Life changed. Mm-hmm. I wrote all of the Barbara and I mimeographed. That's how old we are. We mimeographed the bio and clippings from the European press and sent them to maybe a dozen agents in New York City. And every one of them wrote back and said, stay in Europe. You have it made. The artists are... on our roster are suffering for lack of engagements, especially pianists. There are too many of you. And those were form letters. Some arrived unsigned. It was shocking. And no one prepared me for this. I mean, I was supposed to grow up and be wealthy, famous, and a great virtuoso. So we decided to go to grad school. So I hung out in the warm, moist womb of the academy, and I was at Northwestern University in Evanston, in the shadow of Chicago. And I quit in the middle of it because the kids had to eat, we had to eat. I took a job as a money counter at Arlington Racetrack. I followed with 3 or 4 years as an educator in the poverty programs. And
that brought you east, right?
That brought me east. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted to see New York City.
Was so, that the Vista? Or
that was Job 70 and the Manpower Act, MA-5. Mm-hmm. It was the fifth and final year of the MA programs, and then Job 70 began. And I worked with people that lived in South Bronx, Bedford-Stuyvesant, who were absolutely appreciative of the job training that this particular organization was providing to them. And I had a staff by that time. I had been promoted, and because I was an Army captain, so I knew something about organizational behavior and dynamics. And I did that for, I guess, 4 years, and then I wanted to make a real living, and a headhunter found me and said, "You belong in sales." And I said, "I've never sold a thing in my life." And he said, "I'm going to send you to a company, and they haven't done it either, so maybe you can learn together." And that propelled me into about 15 years of corporate work, and I always was in sales and marketing, eventually at the executive level, of very small consulting companies that had a Fortune 100 client list. And the last job I had, I was CEO and president of a cellular operating telephone company, which was very fortunate. It's why I'm here today, mm-hmm. doing what I want to do.
Now, were you practicing and playing or doing concerts during this period, or
that's a good question. The first 5 years when I left graduate school, I did not touch a piano. I was angry, and I had no interest in it. But I loved the business world, and I loved that the poverty program teaching that I was doing. And after I now realize is I did okay, because it was, again, like music. It's a communicative or communications art. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky. But when I got into, I don't know, the 20 years in which I was involved in business and not in music, I did play after those first 5 years, I think 20 times. People would call me up and say, you know, "Now you're back in the States. Would you come back to Luxembourg and play a recital next season?" And so I did play.
Would you have
15
to,
times? And
would it take a lot of practice?
Yeah, I thought you were going to ask that. Yeah, I was lucky because the practicing actually worked despite the absence. I get up at 5. On a normal day, I would get up at 5 and practice until 7 and head for work. And I would come home. It was important to have supper with the kids. I did that, and then I would practice from 9 to 1. And I did not do that consistently, but if I got... I remember the Northwest Indiana Symphony called me and said, "Okay, here's your chance. Come home and play with what used to be the Gary Indiana Symphony." And... that killed me. They said, "Are you able to do this?" I said, "Well, of course." And they said, "Well, send us your repertoire." So I just listed my 30 favorite piano concerti. I knew I had a year's worth of time to work. And they chose the Brahms first piano concerto, which I loved, the D minor. And I worked my butt off. And then I went to Marty Cannon, who at the time was heir apparent of famous Madame Rosina Levine at Juilliard. And I said, "I am in deep trouble. I need a teacher. Can you help me?" And so he prepared that performance with me. And that was fun. I got to play it twice. And then I wouldn't practice for 6 months or a year. And then I would get another gig. And then since I was traveling in business, I decided I might as well try to take advantage of being out there traveling. And so if I was going to Dallas, you know, I would call up Texas Christian University and say, "Hey, I'm a concert pianist. I'm on the road. I want to try out some new repertoire. Can you put 10 kids, 10 of your undergraduate music kids in a room? I want to play this program. And that did wonders for me. It made me feel whole, which is a trite expression, but that's what it was. And that made my world change holistically. And then some guy came up to me after a concert, a wonderful man, Fred Drosnes. I was playing on Bolton's Land, or Three Brothers Island, off of Bolton's Landing in the Adirondacks. And he said, "You belong in Lincoln Center." And brashly, I said, "Well, yes, I realize that." And he said, "Well, why aren't you there?" And I said, "It takes money." And he actually said, "I've got money. You will play. And you'll play in Alice Tully Hall." And I said, "I think that we should wait. And you, when I get back home," because he was on vacation and he lived in New York City, so I invited him to my home a month or so later. He came with his family. And I said, "Do you feel the same?" And he said, "Of course I do." And he gave me a check. And so that allowed me to make my New York debut, something that had been really eating away at me all my life. I prepared for that. And then it was taken away, you know, in a manner of speaking. And here was my opportunity. So.
And how old were you when you made that premiere, that debut?
Oh, I forget. I was in my 30s. Maybe I was pushing 40.
Mm-hmm.
So I made that debut. No critics, of course, but because of business skills, I developed in those days a mailing list, what today we call a database, and we cut deals. I didn't care how much money I made, but I offered, you know. Organizations that had causes. I had the autistic chapter of, or the New York chapter of the Autistic Association. I gave them a bunch of tickets and said, "Sell these for X amount of money." And they kept all the thing, all of the proceeds, but they had to charge a fee so that it would still have the efficacy of a commercial event, which is both ethically and legally sound. And we put in easily 600 people, and at a debut, 30 people if you're lucky. It's your cousins and your moms and your dads, okay? So we got bus companies to shuttle these folks for nothing. And it was great. It did so much for me emotionally. And I did not drop a lot of notes. I do think I had a couple of memory lapses, but who cares, you know.
Were you playing with music or playing?
No, all from memory.
Uh-huh.
And then I didn't play again for a number of years. And then I got an offer again to go somewhere, and it was great. And so it was a total of I think 15 recitals.
And then the shift back in, did that happen after moving up here, or how did that?
Yes, indeed, it happened after moving up here. We moved up here. We were able to purchase the very first house we ever owned, and it was I have a Fleischman's mailing address and a Margaretville phone number, and we are on top of a mountain. And the first year was really great, mainly because the kids were gone and out of college, and we were responsible, Barbara and I, to no one. So we cleared brush and we built a couple of stone walls. And one day she said, "When are you going to begin practicing again?"
And you were retired. You had retired at this point, or were you still going back?
No. I had no affiliation with anybody.
Uh-huh.
I was out of work. And she said, "When are you going to start practicing?" I said, "Maybe tonight, but I think," she said, "Well, then you got to get a teacher." And I said, "I'll get a teacher when you find someone that can help you learn how to be my booking agent." And this is like a love story. This was great. It was horrible to begin with because I was used to, you know, get me this, get me that. I had been CEO and president, and I always took good care of the people who supported me on my inner circle staff. But I whip-cracked orders and directives like a machine gun. And Barbara wasn't used to that. And so it took us a year to learn how to develop a real teamwork and an understanding between us. And she was fabulous. She met two women who taught her the business of booking concerts. And Barbara made my career. And she worked for me for 15 years doing that. And actually, I worked for her. And I must say, though, that the financial resources ran out after a while. And so she ended up getting a job. She insisted that I not go back to work and that she had built my career and wanted me to keep doing it. And I said, well, that's fine with me as long as you're willing. And she lucked into a job working as the deputy town clerk and deputy tax collector for the town of Woodstock. Mm-hmm. And she put in 10.5 years there. Then she retired, and she became a wonderful mosaic artist. She wins prizes and generates sales. And so we put this idyllic life together. I mean, it's not easy. We were working our butts off all the time. Mm-hmm. But we are fulfilled and no complaints. It built up this way. Barbara got access, thanks to a woman by the name of Dori Huber, H-U-B-A-R. And Dori was in the advertising business in the food service industry. So we ended up somehow acquiring lists of all the people who are in food service. That included military clubs and hospitals and high-end senior citizen villages. And that was the key. Barbara targeted the senior villages, and every one of them have at least a Steinway Concert B, which is 7 feet. They have a cultural program, and I spent 2 years on that senior village circuit. They all have budgets. The first year out, we charged nothing. The second year out, we charged expenses only. Third year out, they were asking us, how much do you charge? We have a budget. And it went from there. And then we went after major concert venues. And the whole business has changed. But that was 20 years ago when we began. And I played at Merkin Concert Hall in the Kaufman Center. I played at Weill Recital Hall at Carnegie and filled it. And I filled it because of Robert Starrer, one of our heroes up here in the Catskills who passed away. And I premiered a work that he dedicated to me. It was his third piano sonata. Critics showed up. Critics liked the concert. I mean, there was a lot of luck involved in this that I don't know why it happened. I played in New York 3 times in 9 years. New York Times covered each of the three with positive commentary. And that's a ticket that you must get punched, mm-hmm. of the many punches that are required in the career ticket. And that was one of them. Because of Robert Starr, I came to know Albany Records. I'm on their label. I'm on their artist roster. They're wonderful to me. And we just kept going for bigger and better venues.
What have you learned from your kind of work path? This both, you've brought together two different worlds, you know, by having spent time in business and as a performing artist with an early career and then a late career. What has this all taught you about both how the arts work and how one needs to work to be an artist, and also just how the arts feeds other manners of work or the business world?
Well, I must say it's all about business. Mm-hmm. Business is the driver. You can say what you want about high art, Western art music, meaning Western Hemisphere, classical music. It's very interesting that if you look at careers of country and Western people, when all of a sudden there was a surge of country Western musicians, why did that all of a sudden occur when in the old days, you know, I mean, Leo Carrillo, I think Tom Mix was a singer, Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, they all started as musicians, but the field of country Western music just didn't have this almost a plethora of performers, and then all of a sudden it occurred, and that's because they went Madison Avenue and Wall Street. As a field, they knew how to market, and you could go through Wall Street and hear country Western music for many years. Chamber music has started to discover that it's a marketing-driven business. Talent is taken for granted. The good news is it's because there are so many talented people that have had the benefit of education. And people have certain prejudices, you know. It all started in Russia, and then it moved, the great pianists, and, you know, and I view the world from the piano bench. And so I'm very colored and prejudice and knowledgeable only from the bench. I've never stood in front of anybody with a fiddle in my arms, let alone conduct or let alone compose. But I can play the piano, and sometimes I play it really great and sometimes really poorly. I don't know why that occurs. It's usually because I haven't prepared. But this idea of just practicing 8 hours a day simply does not work. It didn't work in the old days. There were some exceptions, but artists typically had no skills in anything else. It was strictly music. And I see that still today, where they can't balance their own checkbook. And I'm talking theater, I'm talking dance, I'm talking visual arts. In the fine and performing arts, you've got to have a sense of entrepreneurism. The reason I say that is because that's what works. I cannot play 300 concerts a year because I'm not going to get hired, because there's not enough of a marketplace out there. And there are 15,000 people who on the globe today who consider themselves and call themselves concert pianists. So all I've learned is that if, one, your talent and gift is taken for granted, two, that talent and gift doesn't mean you can read scores from memory or you can analyze Bach chorales and fugues by George Santakis or Kyle Gann or Joan Tower. It means that you've got the ability, a gift, musical gift, includes in that DNA program the ability to communicate with your audience. This requires that you have a good ear so that you listen to yourself and hear what you sound like, not how you think you sound, and the ability to connect and convey a thought, an idea, a concept, just the emotion of excitement. That alone, though, gets you nowhere. You've got to get the message out. And how to do that has changed greatly. And concert agents today don't know how to do that. That's why when you take a look at the budget, you will see that their money is behind people who are already famous. They know, and again, you know, this is like preparation age. It works with some of the people much of the time, but that's, there are exceptions, is my point. They take orders. They do not sell. They no longer build careers. They just put your name on a roster. More often than not, they charge an artist a retainer with no guarantees. Mm-hmm. That retainer for pianists is $1,200 to $1,500 a month. Not true in the world of opera, I've learned, happily. Mm-hmm. Retainers in the opera business are not so much. Instrumentalists, different story, typically. So what is one to do? Even if you were wealthy, that agent's not going to help you, in my way of thinking. You need a product line. You just can't have a career because of the high quality of so many wonderful people and today's economics. People want to be made to laugh or cry or fall off the edge of their seat. This takes an exciting program, meaning what is played and performed, and it's the way it's presented. People say you need a personality. Well, the personality is there if you have the ability to tell a story and get that to be compelling, get that audience to listen to you. You cannot cut them off. The minute you cut them off and you're enjoying yourself playing, then you are emoting. You're playing for yourself, and the story doesn't leave the stage. What I'm trying to say is that almost it takes more than right brain. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's not hemispheric; it's whole. And to have a career, you need that gift that I mentioned. You need to market, and you need to have additional products. It's very unusual to be able to sit, you know, maybe have some students in a studio and make a living playing concerts. You need to teach. You need to, maybe you need to consult. In my case, I play. I lecture. I get paid sometimes for career advising. And this is my life. It's the life of a business person who happens to be artistic, mm-hmm. meaning the musical arts. I hope that answers the question.
But it's a good life, too.
It's a great life. I'm the luckiest guy I know.
Music today was by the pianist Justin Kolb, playing the composer Robert Sterrar, who lived in Woodstock, was married to the great novelist Gail Godwin. Amongst the pieces we heard today were several selections from The Contemporary Virtuoso of 1996, Khaki from Sketches in Color Set 2, a 1973 work, Silver and Gold from the same Sketches in Color, and finally, the gently flowing section from Sonata for Piano No. 3, 1994. This has been The Work Show. Glad you've been listening. My name is Paul Smart. Keep on working.